Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin broadcasting with the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. Today we have with us in our studios a very special guest, Dr. Philip Skell, Emeritus Evan Pugh Professor at Pennsylvania State University and a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Dr. Skell is here visiting Seattle today, so we have him right here in the studios, and we're going to be able to interview him about some of his questions that he has had throughout his career about Darwinian evolution. So, Dr. Skell, thank you very much for being with us in the show today.
Thank you for having me.
I first just want to introduce you to our listeners so they know a little about you and your background as a scientist. Can you please tell us a little bit about your background as a scientist and what you did in your career?
Well, I am trained as a chemist and spent most of my professional life involved in chemical studies, except for a small portion of it that I engaged me during World War II when I was a postdoc at the University of Illinois working on antibiotics, which was essentially a biochemistry type of activity.
So these must have been the pretty early days of antibiotics. You must have been doing some of the most early research into the use of antibiotics. Is that correct?
Well, we were not involved so much in the use of antibiotics, but this was indeed the early days. Penicillin had only become into the consciousness of the broader community fairly recently, and the problems that one had was how to grow the organism and produce enough so that it would have a significant effect on the war casualties that we were experiencing during World War II. I might mention at this point the contributions of a good friend of mine before I went to the University of Illinois. At that time, I was working at the Department of Agriculture Laboratory in Peoria, Illinois, and a lady friend of mine, a technician in a laboratory quite close to mine, made an important contribution to penicillin production. Penicillin, up to that time, could only be grown on the surface of media, and therefore could not be grown in large quantity as one hoped they might be able to do so if it could be grown in vats the way beer, for example, is made in large vats. But the organism that was available that produced penicillin would only grow on the surface. And this lady friend of mine, Mary Hunt, discovered an organism that produced penicillin in deep culture.
Oh.
Now, you might be interested in how this came about. She found in the fruit market a moldy cantaloupe, which she took back to the laboratory, and that is the organism that turned out to be the one that could increase the production of penicillin and made a critical contribution to the war effort. I cite this to you as a good illustration of some of the great breakthrough discoveries that have been made in science.
So you're saying that some of that moldy food in the back of my fridge could actually be holding the keys to curing some disease, is that right? Or
it might very well be, and the work that we did at the University of Illinois was examine a number of different organisms that produced things that seemed to be toxic to bacteria. And this led us into research programs, a very diversified kind of research program, in finding out how these organisms would grow, how to isolate the active ingredient that inhibited the growth of bacteria, what its chemical structure was, and how to assay for it, and so on. The antibiotics we worked on, in addition to penicillin, was streptomycin, streptothricin, clavicin, patulin. the latter ones proved to be too toxic to be of any interest, and the penicillin and streptomycin out of those groups that we studied were the only ones that were of any consequence in use in medicine.
So in the end, you were, I guess, part of the research that helped to pioneer the maybe the widespread use of some of these antibiotic drugs. Is that fair to say? Or
yes, it is fair to say, but the major advances in the field were not produced in our laboratory.
Sure.
We did reasonably good work, but the major contributors to this field were others than ourselves.
Sure. Now, obviously, you have done some fairly important scientific work in your career, as you are a member of the National Academy of Sciences, which, as I understand it, is basically the most exclusive club of major club of scientists in the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about the work that you did that got you elected to the National Academy?
Well, that is a reasonable description of the National Academy of Science. It is an exclusive club of sorts. I don't know what part of my work resulted in my election as a member of the National Academy of Science, because the election procedure is never an open matter to those who are being elected.
Okay.
And even after you're elected, persons do not discuss the grounds on which you've been elected. So I cannot tell you which specific things, or perhaps the aggregate of what we did, were things that resulted in my election to the National Academy.
Okay. If you had to take a guess.
Well, we worked on a number of different projects in my research group at the Pennsylvania State University. Largely, I would characterize them as investigating the chemical behavior of very short-lived intermediates that are involved in carrying out chemical reactions. And we found ways of investigating these intermediates that have such short lives of the order of billionth or shorter, billionth of a second or shorter lifetime. We found that we could characterize them in the same way that we characterize ordinary stable chemicals by trapping them with reagents under suitable conditions, and in that way we could interpret the chemical properties of those very short-lived intermediates. Some of them are called free radicals, some are called carbenes, and related things related to that. The free radicals have a central carbon atom without the usual four groups attached to a carbon atom. They had three groups attached to the carbon atom, and those are free radicals. The carbenes had only two other groups attached to the carbon atom, and there one faced the question of what the other electrons surrounding the carbon atom were doing, and it was postulated by others that the electrons could either be paired with one another or they could be unpaired. Mm-hmm. And we reasoned that this would give those two varieties of carbene different chemical properties, and we were successful in carrying out experiments which showed that they indeed did have different chemical properties. That may be one of the things that attracted attention to our laboratory and the work we were doing. We extended that into the examination of other reactive intermediates, of short-lived ones, to get information about them. One major group of them were the free atoms, and most persons might assume that chemists have been studying the reactions of atoms all along, but it turns out that there was no good way to examine the properties, the chemical.
Because they're usually locked up in a larger molecule.
They are locked up in strong bonds to neighboring atoms like themselves.
Sure.
Which greatly changed their chemical properties.
Mm-hmm.
For example, carbon atoms had not been reasonably studied because there had been no good way to generate the carbon atoms. If you take a diamond or a piece of graphite, you can vaporize them at temperatures of the order of 2,500 degrees or more, and they exist as free atoms under those conditions. But the question we asked was, how would those free atoms react with other chemical reagents at room temperature or below? At 2,500 degrees, there might be reactions, but the products would be extremely unstable and would give us little information if we could find them. We devised a piece of equipment that enabled us to vaporize the carbon and separate the space between the point of vaporization and the point of reaction with other molecules by a high vacuum, so that there would be no collisions as the vaporized carbon atoms went through that vacuum and landed on a target, which was the walls of the container, that was coated with the molecules we wanted the carbon atoms to react with. And that turned out to be successful, and we were able to describe the chemistry, free carbon atoms, with a variety of different substances. This turned out to be a general procedure. 90% or more of the elements had never had their atoms, their free atom chemistry, described. And this method made it possible to produce iron atoms by evaporating iron metal and studying its reaction with various things, or molybdenum atoms or platinum atoms, and so on. So the method was broadly applicable.
And maybe briefly, because we are reaching the end, I think, of this first interview we'll do with you, did your research have any sort of practical implications or practical applications?
I don't think of any at the moment. It added greatly to our fund of knowledge about the behavior of these atoms. But so far as I am aware, no important practical outcome was derived from that work. Perhaps it will be sometime in the future, but one doesn't know. We were interested in the fundamental chemistry of the free atoms, which over the century or more of modern chemistry had not been a subject that people could describe, and we were able to describe that chemistry.
And that's very important. And there's one interesting thing that conspicuously you have not said in this interview, and that is that you never said that you based your research, or you were inspired to do this research, based upon Darwinian evolution. And I know that you are quite a skeptic of Darwinian evolution, and you've written about this, and I think we will be able to talk about this some more in subsequent podcasts. For now, however, I just want to ask you a question, because we're on the track of discussing your scientific career. The National Academy of Sciences, of which you are a member, has been quite active and vocal in this debate over evolution. And as I'm sure you're aware, you know, they've issued these statements from time to time against intelligent design and supporting evolution. And there have been some controversial surveys that have come out in the last decade, I think one of which published in the journal Nature in the late 90s, discussed how, I think it was somewhere around 95% of the biologists of that NAS describe themselves as atheists or agnostics. And they get very involved with this debate over evolution. I guess my question for you is, in your experience with fellow members of the National Academy of Science, are they fairly one-sided in their view on evolution? Are they, perhaps you might even say, biased? Or are you willing to comment on this?
Yes, I can comment on it. My sense is that they do carry a bias in favor of it, which was much the same as the bias that I had lived with through most of my professional career. It wasn't until after I retired from activities in chemistry that I was led to think about the question in a way that I hadn't been induced to think about it earlier. This came about by reading the philosophical works of a very famous chemist who is now dead, Michael Polanyi, who halfway through his career became interested in philosophy and metaphysics and wrote as a chemist that I could understand. And in retirement, in reading his books, I was sensitized to the notion that Darwinian theory about evolution was not nearly as solidly supported by the evidence as is often told to us, and which I had learned as a student. And it started me thinking about the work I had done.
Phil, this is a great story, but we're running out of time for this podcast. So I think what we'll do is we'll continue this, and this will whet the appetites for our listeners for the next podcast, and they'll be able to hear more about your journey from being a essentially standard Darwinian to becoming a Darwin skeptic. But thank you very much for starting to tell us this story right now, and I'm sure our listeners will look forward to hearing the rest of it very soon.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this.
Okay, well, this is Casey Luskin with the ID the Future podcast. Stay tuned. We're going to have more with Dr. Philip Skell, member of the National Academy of Sciences and former professor at Pennsylvania State University, now professor emeritus at Pennsylvania State University. This is Casey Luskin. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.